It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The other thing I almost always do, unless the tenant says, no, this is just going to make things way, way worse, is I'll call the landlord, and usually I have to schedule about half an hour for that. Because you have to listen to a lot of ranting about how your client is like the worst tenant in the whole world and they're just taking advantage of everybody. But I find that, you know, 90% of the time, the landlord getting a call saying, you know, this is legal aid, it's unlawful for you to shut off the utilities, you need to turn back the heat back on, you know, if you don't, you could be liable for damages, you could be liable for attorney's fees, that's usually enough to scare them into turning it back on or letting the tenant back in. So unless my client says, no, I really think that's going to make it worse, please don't do that. I basically always do that in addition to the letter because it solves a lot of the problems a lot quicker than going to court.
Legal Aid Justice Center attorney Brenda Castaneda talks about utilities in public and private housing and how to handle common disputes such as billing, repairs, or shutoffs. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about an international exhibit, Lawyers Without Rights, presented by the German Federal Bar and the American Bar Association, now in Richmond from December 15, 2013 through February 2, 2014. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 224, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. What would you do if you lost all of your rights? That was the question faced by Jewish lawyers under the Third Reich in Germany, when suddenly they became lawyers without rights. The relatively peaceful times of the Weimar Republic came to an abrupt end on January 30, 1933, when Hindenburg granted power to Adolf Hitler. The democratic state ceased to exist. On that day, the fate of German Jews was sealed. Jews were excluded from all areas of social life. In Justice II, a distinction was made between Jews and non-Jews. As early as March 1933, a decree was issued which refused all Jewish judges, public prosecutors, and lawyers access to the courts from the following day. Holocaust history lecturer J. M. Ibsen is hosting the international exhibit Lawyers Without Rights, presented by the German Federal Bar in cooperation with the American Bar Association. Depicted on 23 panels is the dramatic story of Jewish lawyers, judges, professors, and other professionals deprived of their rights in Germany as a result of the 1933 Nuremberg Laws. Already viewed in 40 international sites, this exhibit will be in Richmond from December 15, 2013 through February 2, 2014 at the Gay Community Center Gallery, 1407 Sherwood Avenue, Richmond, located behind the Diamond. The exhibit reflects a time in Germany when the individual rights and the rule of law were utterly neglected. Many non-Jewish German lawyers in those days kept silent. They did not say a word. There was no real resistance. Most of them did not even try to help their colleagues. They failed to act, and so did the lawyers' organizations. Since it was first displayed in 2000, Lawyers Without Rights has been shown in more than 70 cities in Germany and all over the world. The exhibit will be staffed with knowledgeable volunteers from local schools, colleges, and the general public. In addition to the traveling exhibit, one panel will display the personal experience of a Richmond Holocaust survivor, Israel Ibsen, who passed away in 1997 and also lost his rights as a Lithuanian Jewish lawyer during the Holocaust. Unlike some of the other lawyers who were executed, he managed to outwit the Germans and escape with his family to pursue a new life in America. The exhibit is open daily from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. with free admission at the Gay Community Center Gallery, 1407 Sherwood Avenue, Richmond. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Landlords must provide fit and habitable premises with access to utilities, but what does that mean in practice? Legal Aid Justice Center attorney Brenda Castaneda spoke about utilities in public and private housing and how to handle common disputes such as billing, repairs, or shutoffs at the annual statewide conference of legal aid attorneys, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are Brenda's comments.
I'm going to just start by talking about what does the landlord need to provide. The landlord needs to provide functional heat, hot water, water, electricity, basic utilities. The landlord does not have to pay for those if the tenant can get them from a public utility. And the lease usually will say whether the utilities need to be in the tenant's name or not. That can be important because, you know, sometimes people just don't always go by what the lease says, and it can be a lease violation if your client has not put the utilities in their name and they're required to by the lease. Another issue that has come up recently is there's been a change in the law, so the landlord can be held liable for up to 3 months' worth of municipal, like, water or sewer charges incurred by a tenant, and so if that's coming up with your clients, that's something to look out for, and that utility can then refuse to connect water or sewer service for a new tenant if the landlord hasn't paid the charges. So that landlord might try to shift the burden onto the tenants in some way and make them pay either for past tenants or maybe try to ask for an extra deposit. But there's really nothing under the VRLTA that allows the landlord to ask for any additional deposit above 2 months' rent, and that's true under the Mobile Home Lot Rental Act as well. So that could be an argument against that, and the landlord can't obviously shift the burden to a new tenant to pay for the old tenant's utilities. That's the landlord's job to make sure that the utilities are functional and can be hooked up. What do you do when there's a shutoff? And there's actually quite a few remedies provided under state law, and what you would choose to do would really depend on the situation with your client, whether they're current on rent, whether they're not current on rent, whether they're capable of getting the utilities back on with the company, putting them in their own name, whether they're able to move out or maybe want to move out quickly. So there's a lot of options, and which one you would choose would just depend on the situation. So the first option would be to do a 2130 notice to the landlord, and that would only be if you're looking at a VRLTA tenancy or mobile home lot tenancy. Under that statute, the tenant can give a written notice to the landlord that they're in non-compliance, and I'm sure we've all seen tenants get 2130s, but the tenant can give a similar notice to the landlord. So 21 days to fix it, or the lease terminates in 30 days, or if it's non-remediable, they can just give a 30-day notice. So the advantage to that is that the tenant can get out without going to court. They can just give the notice, and the landlord doesn't fix it, then they can leave. The disadvantage is that you're not going to court, so there's been no adjudication as to whether the lease was properly terminated, and the landlord comes back and says, well, now you're on the hook for the rest of the rent for the year, and I'm going to sue you because you broke the lease. There's always the risk that the tenant wouldn't prevail in court, and then they could end up on the hook for additional rent. There's also an option under the same statute that if you do, you can go to court and you can ask for injunctive relief, attorney's fees, and damages under this statute. So I usually think of it like if somebody comes in and just wants to get out, I use it that way, like not going to court. But the statute does provide that you can go into court and get injunctive relief and attorney's fees and damages under this statute. I think the downside is it's slower. Obviously, if they have 21 days to fix the issue. So, you know, if the heat's off and it's January, that's probably not a good solution. A similar option would be to file suit under the wrongful failure to provide heat, hot water, or electricity or essential services statute. That's also just under PRLTA and Manufactured Home Lot Rental Act. Again, you need to give written notice to the landlord about what the issue is. And under that statute, you can get damages or you can get substitute housing, the cost of substitute housing, and you can get attorney's fees. So that would be, again, a suit for damages. This wouldn't get you out right away, like the 2130, or it wouldn't get you out without going to court. It does give you damages if you have damages. I think the problem is that with a lot of our clients, the damages aren't very great because the damages may be that they had to go eat out at McDonald's because their food spoiled, or it may be that they may end up couch surfing with a relative instead of paying for a hotel. So it just depends on what your client's damages are, whether that's a good option. And if the landlord has some kind of counterclaim, like for rent, this may not be a good option. If the landlord turned off the utilities because the tenant owes 3 months of rent, that could pretty quickly outstrip any damages that the tenant has. So our new favorite one is the unlawful ouster statute. It's our brand new form. We are so excited about this. So in the past, you had to go to circuit court and file a complaint and a motion for an injunction and try to get an emergency hearing. But as of this July, we got the statute changed so that now you can petition in general district court, and we have this brand new beautiful form, and it's sort of an open question about how courts are going to be handling these, you know, and I think that for the few that have been filed across the state so far, I think people have generally found that the general district courts are really receptive to giving hearings right away. We don't know yet how judges are going to handle whether the general district court judges will be comfortable issuing ex parte injunctions if that landlord has not been able to be served yet to restore utilities. And we're not sure how the courts will handle it if the landlords just refuse to comply. So under this statute, you don't need to send a letter to the landlord under this one if they've been unlawfully excluded or the utilities have been shut off. You can just go ahead and file. If the tenant really needs to get that in right away, needs the electricity on right away or the heat on right away, this is a good option. The tenant does not have to be current on rent or anything like that to file this. A fourth option that we've sometimes used is filing a tenant's assertion. This is slower. It's a slower option, but it does get you into court. So again, it just depends on the tenant's ability to sort of deal with the situation in the interim. And if you know, they don't have water, but they're able to sort of bring in jugs and shower the neighbors, maybe this is a better option. It depends. The downside to this is that tenant does need to be current on rent to file. And written notice needs to be given to the landlord. The most common situation is the tenant's not current on rent, and that is why the landlord has turned off the utilities. You know, but every now and then, there's just some bad blood between the landlord and tenant, and the tenant, you know, the landlord wants the tenant gone for some other reason and decides to turn them off, and the tenant may be current on rent. So in those situations, it does work. I found that the courts, at least in Central Virginia and Charlottesville and Albemarle, they'll set a hearing fairly soon. So they'll do it within 2 weeks, and they'll set it straight for a hearing, and they won't set it on the docket date because they assume it's a conditions issue and that the tenant needs it addressed. The good thing about this option is that there are a lot of things the judge can do. So once the tenant files, then the tenant can escrow rent. You have to escrow the rent within 5 days of when it's due, but you can file any time. Like if you filed mid-month, you wouldn't need to escrow rent right mid-month. You wait till it's due, and then you escrow it when it's due. The judge can terminate the lease and let the tenant out. The judge can order repairs to be done. The judge can return escrow money, some or all of it, to the tenant. The judge can order for repairs to be paid out of the escrow. The judge can decide that the tenant is just full of it and give all the money to the landlord. And the judge, and I've never seen them do this, but they can set it out for a further hearing and order that the local authorities, the building inspector or whoever, go out and look at it. This option can work. We did do this last year when we had sort of a rural situation where the guy was in a trailer on a piece of land and his landlord was on the next piece of land over, and they shared a well, and she had turned off the well, and he was sort of able to deal with it in the interim, and we did the tenant's assertion, and that, that was effective.
You've been listening to Legal Aid Justice Center attorney Brenda Castaneda talking about utilities in public and private housing and how to handle common disputes such as billing, repairs, or shutoffs at the annual statewide conference of Virginia Legal Aid Attorneys. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Brenda Castaneda, attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center, talking about utilities in public and private housing and how to handle common disputes such as billing, repairs, or shutoffs.
It's really important to figure out what the client wants when they come in. Do they want to leave? Is this a good time for them to just get out and go and use the excuse that now the landlord's turned off the utilities so I can go and get out of the next 5 months of rent on my lease? Because the landlord's misbehaving. Do they want to just get the utilities back on and stay there? And, sometimes they just don't have other options. They need to be there, whether they're current on rent or not. They just don't have the ability to get out very quickly. And do they have damages? And do they want to go forward and try to get damages against the landlord? So figuring that out will sort of dictate then which, option on your option tree that you... It's also, I think it's good to figure out, is this landlord just a lone bad actor? Is this like a bigger issue? Like there's, power been cut to an entire building. Do you want to go to general district court with it and ask for damages or for the petition to get back in? Do you want to go to circuit court? Do you want to just send the termination notice and move in? All of those are options. Under almost all of the statutes we just talked about, I think the ouster statute, you do need to write a letter. So I think it's good practice to get a letter to the landlord regardless, because it just gives you a paper trail. I find that often, whether you write the letter for the tenant and it comes from you, or it's signed by the tenant, like that's an important consideration. A lot of times I just talk to my client like, do you think it's going to make the situation escalate if the landlord gets a lawyer letter? Is that going to freak them out and make them dig in harder? Or will it scare them into compliance? And the tenant knows the landlord better than I do. So I sort of say, well, I can do this and I can put my name on it if you think that's the scarier thing, or we can put your name on it. So there's that sort of practical consideration. And I think there's also an evidentiary consideration. Like I find it easier when I end up in court to have a letter, even though I've written the whole thing, to have my client's signature on it and have them have mailed it. We'll sit there and we'll do that. We'll write it. I'll read it to them, make sure they understand what's in it. Does this look correct? Okay, good. And then here's the letter. Here's a stamp. Go put this in the mail. Because I've had adverse counsel really grill my client, well, who wrote this? And the judge is sort of like, well, it doesn't matter who wrote it. But it can be hard to get the evidence in about how, that it was sent, that it was actually mailed, if you took it and used the Pitney Bowes machine and stamped it and put it out with your mail. So I actually find it's helpful to have the client sign it, have the client put it in the mailbox, because it just makes it easier for me in court to just say, did you write this letter? Did you mail it? And then the other thing I almost always do, unless the tenant says, no, this is just going to make things way, way worse, is I'll call the landlord, and usually I have to schedule about half an hour for that, because you have to listen to a lot of ranting about how your client is like the worst tenant in the whole world, and they're just taking advantage of everybody. But I find that, you know, 90% of the time, the landlord getting a call saying, you know, this is legal aid, it's unlawful for you to shut off the utilities, you need to turn back the heat back on. You know, if you don't, you could be liable for damages, you could be liable for attorney's fees. That's usually enough to scare them into turning it back on or letting the tenant back in. So unless my client says, no, I really think that's going to make it worse, please don't do that, I basically always do that in addition to the letter, because it solves a lot of the problems a lot quicker than going to court. One of the big issues that we run into is figuring out damages. Like Dathan was pointing out, you could ask for an abatement of the rent. You could say, well, you know, I didn't have electric for this amount of time, so my rent was worth less. Figuring out how much less is it worth? That's an issue. It's almost, you know, if they weren't completely excluded, is there some value to them having a roof over their head, even if they didn't have heat for 3 days? And, you know, I mean, I don't have a good solution for this. I've often just sort of put an arbitrary number on it. I always tell my clients to keep all your receipts. Like, if you have to go eat out, if you have groceries you just bought that are spoiling in the fridge or freezer, take a picture of it. You know, a record of any belongings that might be damaged or destroyed. You know, I guess if the electricity is off, the usual thing is spoiled food. There may be other things as well. I think that a big problem we've come across is that, you know, like I said, if your client ends up couch surfing instead of paying for a hotel, well, their damages are less, but the inconvenience was probably a lot more to them. And since the statutory remedies are all actual damages, it's really hard to prove. Trespass is a good one if the landlord came on the premises at all to do the shutoff. And there's a good case that was pointed out to me recently, Johnson v. Marcel, which is 251 VA 58. It's a 1996 Virginia Supreme Court case. In that case, the landlord did some pretty egregious things, coming in and ripping wires out of the wall and so forth. And the court allowed the tenants to ask for punitive damages in that case. So because the actual damages often don't amount to very much, it's good if you can to sort of figure out a way that you can ask for punitive damages.
You've been listening to Legal Aid Justice Center attorney Brenda Castaneda talking about utilities in public and private housing and how to handle common disputes such as billing, repairs, or shutoffs at the annual statewide conference of Virginia Legal Aid Attorneys. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
I'm Michelle King for the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Here's this week's Legal Aid success story, a true tale where justice prevailed. Juanita and Ron lived on a couple of acres of land near Portland, Oregon, where they owned and operated an auto repair shop. Ron did the repairs while Juanita handled the bookkeeping and took care of the kids. In 1996, Ron had two heart attacks, leaving him weakened and unable to work the same long hours he had in the past. Juanita tried to keep the auto shop going using hired mechanics, but they lost customers who had been loyal to Ron. Eventually, the couple lost their business and their home, causing Juanita to suffer a heart attack as well. At first, the Oregon Health Plan covered the couple's medical bills and prescription drugs, but the state budget shortfall in 2003 caused them to lose all of their benefits. Juanita only learned after being charged $140 for one of her 7 prescriptions and an amount she could not afford to pay without a steady income.
Eventually, Juanita contacted Legal Aid Services of Oregon, whose attorneys were able to restore the couple's medical coverage, allowing them to purchase the prescription drugs they desperately needed. When the attorney called, it was the best phone call I ever had, Juanita said. I was sitting there with a heart rate of 120, and I couldn't afford to pick up the medicine. It was a lifesaver. Ron agreed. Just knowing that legal aid is out there to help gives you more confidence so that you can breathe a little bit easier. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Aid Success Story, a true tale where justice prevailed.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. In a child custody or visitation case, there may be an attorney for the mother and the father, but what about the child? Join us next week when private attorney Jill Pierce explains the role and responsibility of a court-appointed guardian ad litem for a child in a family law case in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on June 6, 2012. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.